Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Saleri Report. Today is Thursday, September 9th, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, Money and Markets, then the Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders, who we've just confirmed is here. We have a ton of questions. The focus, I'm going to try and handle as many of your precious metals questions as possible. We're going to talk about the next date, a date, as I said on the blog, to live in financial infamy, 1913, and the creation of the Federal Reserve Bank. So next date in the dates, most important dates in the history of precious metals. We also want to talk about a topic that keeps coming up again and again, and Franklin and I thought we would just really spend a little bit of time on it tonight, and that's the risks involved with receiving and using federal government money. There's no movie tonight. If you really want the best piece on the Federal Reserve, my top choice would be a book. There are several books, but one is The Creature from Jekyll Isle by Ed Griffith. It's one of the candidates for the top 20 books for the 21st century, and he's somebody I hope to have on the Saleri Report before too long. Our theme tonight is we are all entrepreneurs now. There's something very positive going on as it becomes more and more evident that there is no help that's going to come from Washington or Wall Street. It's almost as though people are sort of leaving the Titanic and building arcs and learning to like it. And this applies even if you're on your own as, you know, running a small business like Franklin and me, or even if you have a job, because now being an employee now requires more entrepreneurial skills. You know, organizations are having to be more entrepreneurial. It's a tougher environment. So we're sort of all entrepreneurs now. I work out with a wonderful athlete in Hickory Valley, and he was laid off by the local gym and said to me, I need a job. And I said, no, you don't need a job. You need lower expenses and several sources of income that you can manage. So now he's training several people independently in this swapping property management work for his rent, and he's found a variety of other small projects that he gets paid for. He keeps looking for a job, but he's not waiting for the job before he builds his sources of both income and reduced expenses. We're all entrepreneurs now. There's so much to be said for being useful no matter where you are and no matter what is going on, because being useful can lead to the creation of real products, services, and businesses. All the businesses I have now came out of me just answering people's questions as I started to do radio shows and write articles, and their questions all organized around what can I do with respect to this and that, and the next thing you know, many years later, I've got several businesses where I'm doing that as a business, is handling those questions I used to get. Money and markets. I want to stand back and sort of look at the big picture, because there's not a lot new from what I've said in the year-end wrap-up and the quarterly reports. We have the grinding of the gears as all of these infrastructures that have built up on cheap government capital and cheap oil have to reconcile themselves to changed cash flows and having to now carry the burden of the debt that's been created to kind of make the cash flows work last year. I've said earlier my last prediction was 70% chance, slow burn, 15% chance. We get another 2008 and 15% chance it spirals, you know, worse than 2008. And I think the question in a lot of people's minds as we come out of the summer and Labor Day is, are the chances of that 15 plus 15% growing? We had reports that job claims were down today. Don't believe it. 9 states hadn't got in their numbers because of Labor Day, and so there was more government estimation. The numbers really don't, they don't indicate what's going on. We're watching. We continue to watch growing long-term unemployment and growing concern across the country that this is a real structural issue. I hate to beat the drum again, but if you go back and read the Dylan Reed story or watch the wonderful Sir James Goldsmith, what you'll know is, of course, it's a structural change. We knew it was coming many years ago. We knew it was being engineered. Part of the problem is there's been an absence of mark-to-market in the economy of the kind we had in 89 at the end of the last housing bubble. And part of it is the mark would have to be so big and so painful that I think there is tremendous fear of a spiral down. Not of the kind I would fear, but of the kind if you're a large bank, you certainly would fear. All of that is arguing for many people to continue to manage the slow burn. Obama has come out with a new stimulus package and tax benefits. It reflects real concerns that the Democrats are now expected to lose the House in the election. It looks like they don't have, they're probably not in risk of losing the Senate. The Senate would be a harder swing. The proposals really keep a variety of parties afloat. It lacks a vision that makes sense. And in fact, that vision would have had to have happened on the last round of stimulus in 2008 and in 2009. What happened is we had a president run in a campaign where he promised the sun and the moon and then basically took the rest of the equity capital in the country and shot it into the banks. And so now that the administration has shot its wad, there's really nothing it can do except face the long prospect of the grinding of the gears while it tries to give good speeches and comes up with stimulus proposals that are really sort of tinkering at the edges. One of the fundamental problems with coming up with a vision that makes sense is you're watching a steady drip, drip, drip of draining small business and small farmers with administration proposals. Health care, not just the legislation itself, but the process of developing the legislation, was a frightening prospect for many small business people. I mean, I remember talking to one entrepreneur who, in their family, they have, they have a not-for-profit, a trade association, or private business, and they're looking at me with panic in their face and saying, you know, we'll have to shut everything down or radically re-engineer. We have no idea what we're going to do. So ditto food safety, very, very frightening, and certainly nothing to do with safety, really the opposite. Bank bailouts, all of these have a dramatic impact on raising expenses and the time expense for small business and small business owners and managers, and what that means is their equity is automatically lowered. And because it doesn't trade on the New York Stock Exchange, it's not as visible to many people. It also creates uncertainty. And as we all sit and wait for regulations that tell us, will we really have to give a 1099 form to everybody that a business pays $600 to? So. And then on top of it, you have a lot of small business owners with 401ks and IRAs that are now, you know, the prospect of proposals that I would describe as confiscation are now being dangled out in hearings by Treasury and Department of Labor. So what that all adds up to is just 2 years of slaughtering small business equity, increasing small business risk. And now you're turning around at election time and saying, oh, we're going to make it possible for you to depreciate more equipment for the next 2 years. Well, whoopee. It's really, you know, it's a double bind. It's kind of punching a guy and then giving him a dollar. And it's certainly not, small business people need to see an opportunity to get something done in the real world. And this kind of tinkering won't do it. New development, it has become socially acceptable to discuss sovereign defaults. Morgan Stanley has a new report basically saying the question is not when we have sovereign defaults, but how. Now, recognize what they mean by default may not be a technical debt default, but simply abrogation of promises, whether social benefits or simply inflating away the value of the currency to pay. And it's, in one sense, it's healthy that this conversation is beginning, because the reality is that the paper and debt we've created is, you know, as many multiples of the real economy. And again, unless we have a radical bringing out of new technology out from the laboratory, which is always possible, there's going to have to be a reconciliation. And that's what you're watching when you watch all the sort of hoopla and squabbling going on in Washington. Again, what you're watching is three people fighting for the same pot. One is retirement benefits, as in Social Security and health care. The second is the banks in terms of interest on the debt and the sort of worldwide creditors. And finally, the military, whether it's the overt budget or the black budget. real investors continued to take funds out of the stock market, and it was bad enough, to my surprise, that the chairman of the SEC commented that the flash crash has damaged investors' confidence. And clearly that is the case. But I don't think it's just the flash crash. It's the flash crash on top of, you know, Madoff and Enron and this and that. And basically the feeling now that this market is not under adult supervision and retirement savings is precious and shouldn't be subject to these kinds of risk. We continue to see the rebalancing globally of the economy moving to the emerging markets. Reports that the Chinese and the Russians are now going to start to trade each other's currencies. Trading opening expected to open in Shanghai later this month. This is important because Russia provides energy and China is a major consumer of energy, and if they're trading that energy in their own currencies, that could be what I call a trim tab, a little change that makes a very big change. Now, in the middle of what are very serious economic and political issues to reconcile a mound of paper to a real economy, which is hurting from many years of this kind of financial system, the volume and the ferociousness of the disinformation is increasing. And if there's any hope I have for you this fall, it's please, please, please do not lose time in the disinformation. Let me give you some examples of things that are really important to ignore or see for what they are. The most dangerous of the latest ones are some of the food recalls and the spin around the food recalls, clearly being engineered to try and push the food safety bill through the Senate. This is a classic economic warfare game. In fact, I've seen instances where I've seen food safety instances, which I think were poisoning, really trumped up to try and accomplish some kind of food safety purpose. And so that's not to say that they don't come up with legitimate examples. Lord knows there are plenty in industrial agriculture and food processing, but a lot of what you're seeing around this food recall issue is really a game to engineer central control of the food system. Another one, the Muslim versus Americans coming into the 9/11 anniversary, 2 days away. A lot of this is trumped up. You'll never see these articles on the blog. There are plenty of tensions between East and West and Muslim versus America, but the real clash of civilization on planet Earth is between the lawless and the lawful, not Muslim versus Christians or East versus West. You and I have much more in common with ethical-loving people in Muslim countries or of the Islamic faith than the folks running the narcotics trafficking for the black budget. So, that's not the real frame, and that's one of the things we talked about last week, is what's the real frame on the real clash of civilization, which is going on planet Earth, and it's profound. And the people who we are not in alignment with are the ones who are sort of stirring the pot on Muslim versus Americans coming into 9/11. So it's a fake frame. Try to ignore it if you can. I just went down to the Barn Grill at the wonderful Thunder Bay Resort where I'm in Michigan tonight. I'm going to do a workshop tomorrow on regional economic prosperity and development. And while I was using the Wi-Fi in the Barn Grill, I watched 60 minutes of sex slave trafficking, rape, and sexual harassment on CNN almost nonstop, which was accompanied with constant show of pictures of beautiful young women. The reporting was very shrill and aggressive, you know, full of trigger words. And I said, you know, they must really be worried about the economy if we've got 60 minutes of sex slave trafficking and rape, you know, without even any food. Good heavens. But it's a perfect example of sort of the aggression of the disinformation really ramping up. A tremendous risk that that I'm seeing come up, and I wanted to mention it because I'm very suspicious, is the proposal, and it's coming from all sides of the political spectrum, that we have a constitutional convention. The idea being we need amendments for, among other things, taking away the right of corporate personhood. All of the proposals come down to very good ideas, and it speaks to the deep desire for one big, quick solution. Now, if you understand what the real problem is, The real solutions require a lifetime of thousands of little and big changes, real deep cultural and political change and economic change. But the thing that disturbs me about it is people should really know better. It's a proof, again, of how either naive people are or the, I hate to say this, the number of folks who have control files. What the powers that be would love nothing more than is a grassroots movement to get a constitutional convention. Once they get it, it leaves Congress free to make changes without state approval. Under the Constitution, the Congress can make these changes. They could never do it politically without a grassroots movement to ride. And so if the grassroots opens it up, just get ready for Mr. Global to, you know, to stuff corporate feudalism through. Two of the things they most want is freedom from constitutional rules on government spending. That way the black budget can go totally on budget, and freedom from 10th Amendment and other state and local rights. If we do have a constitutional convention, watch for a conversion to a legal framework based on complete central control. That's an interim step to the elimination of private property. So don't worry about confiscation of gold. Worry about a constitutional convention leading to the eventual confiscation of just about everything. Hero of the week. Let me mention David Post, who I have never met. I've talked to him on the phone. I'm looking forward to meeting him tomorrow. He's the village manager of Hillman, Michigan. Hillman is a town in the northeast Michigan peninsula next to Lake Huron. It's absolutely beautiful. As I said before, I'm up at the Thunder Bay Resort to do a workshop. And I drove into town today. I have a habit of sort of driving around the town and trying to estimate out the financial ecosystem. And I drove into Hillman and had a late lunch and stopped by several stores. And I was just amazed at the friendliness of the people and the beauty, the natural beauty of the place is extraordinary. But what you also see around a town like this, and you'll see it in a town like Honewell, Tennessee, is there's been a real effort to really build up, you know, whether it's parks or various facilities, to build up the town in a way that's clearly evidenced by great municipal government leadership. And you can see these towns when you come into them. It's a reminder of what local leadership can accomplish despite unbelievable challenges. It's always very inspiring. Reminds me of when I saw Tina Turner in a concert when she was in her 60s. And I turned to my friend who'd gotten the tickets, and I said, what's our excuse? Anyway, so I say this because we're coming into elections this year, and it's so important that we take an interest in our local candidates. Right now, the quality of local municipal officials is very important, both elected and appointed, particularly given the constitutional framework that's still in effect. So, you can't do everything, but take an interest, pick out the election that's important to you locally, learn about it, and take an interest. If you're busy, just give a little bit of money. But a little bit of interest at the local level can go a long way and get a very big result. So with that, we have a lot happening in the markets, and so let me begin the precious metals market report, Franklin.
Yes. I'm right here.
Summer's over, and it appears the price of gold and silver are moving up. So what did the chart say?
Well, today was an odd day. You don't know how to interpret it, whether what we saw was the top in a market or just a sort of breather before silver and gold go much higher. There's a market proverb that bull markets always climb a wall of worry. And that's what we've seen in the last month and a half. All sorts of people telling you all the reasons why gold and silver can't go any higher. And yet they have relentlessly moved higher. Gold to a new high. Silver over the resistance that for more than 2 years has stood in its way right at $20. Say 1985 or so. So today they backed off a little bit, and it's not clear to me. I think they have higher to go yet in this move, and you'll probably see three or four days, maybe a week of slightly lower prices, and then you'll go up to new highs for silver. It's especially important for silver. And the reason is because the whole gold, the whole precious metals bull market needs to be confirmed by new highs in silver. And, of course, the old high, the 2008 high, is $20.68. We saw $20.14 today, which is the highest price since spring of 2008. So we're really making progress. But the thing is that, and I hate to talk in intuitive terms, but I have to. This is a market that has a feel that it's going higher. Now, if it, you know, if we saw silver below 1980, gold below 1210, I'd say, well, maybe I'm wrong. But those would be, if we got a significant correction that lasted a couple of weeks, those would be the levels I'm looking at. But they're just, Catherine, it's just crazy how much strength there is under this market. It just, and I have to say, I'll admit, I'm a conspiratorialist. I believe that in 1934, the government actually set up a means to intervene in the market called the Exchange Stabilization Fund, and they've been using it ever since because that's what they set it up for. And you just, you know, when you see gold make a new high and silver drop 3 cents, it just doesn't, it, you know, there's no logic to that. Now, admittedly, there ought to be some difficulty for any market to get through these tough resistance levels, like the old, you know, this new all-time high in gold and silver's 2008 high. Sure, there's going to be, you know, there's going to be difficulty getting through that, no question. But it's just bogus. I mean, just like the stock market, you look at the stock market, and the action there is bogus. All day long, it's down 100, 150 points. And then, oops, right at the end, it somehow manages to rise and close 7 points higher. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
Well,
but over time, that wears out.
Yeah, that's why I think we're seeing the withdrawals from the market, is people losing confidence in the fundamental, you know, just the fundamental integrity of the thing.
Oh, sure.
I put a post. There's a wonderful money manager who I really respect, and I put up a quote from him on the blog this week where he said, look, you know, you can criticize me for and he's an equity investor. He doesn't like gold and silver, but he's got a huge position now. And he said, you know, you can criticize me for doing this, but I have gold and silver. It's in a vault. It's not a digit on somebody else's system that can disappear.
Right.
And that, you know, that's a shocking statement for someone in his position to say. You know, it shows a certain lack of confidence in the system.
Well, it shows that the system's coming apart. I mean, that's the direction that it goes, at least.
Right.
So that's the most frightening kind of thing you can hear.
Well, you know, it's funny that I track the news every day, and I must say that I find all of the debate on both sides of the precious metals market to be increasingly shrill, and I have trouble relating to both of them. Mm-hmm. So you have some people saying, you know, gold's going to the moon, mm-hmm. and on one side, and then you have other people saying it's going to crash and, you know, drop dramatically. And both sides are equally shrill and not taking, you know, it's not an integrated, sound discussion. It's really, you know, it's really economic warfare. They're arguing for their positions.
Well,
it's ideological
thinking. It's not rational thinking. It's ideological thinking. I've got a position, and I'm going to defend that position come hell or high water, is what it is. And
well, is it ideological, or are they just arguing for what will make them money?
Well, that's always part of an ideology, is that they expect to make money out of it. You know, that's the reason they support it. But
well, we have a tremendous number of questions, and I just wanted to run through some of them because they really do bear on the market. You know, one of the concerns that we got from several subscribers is if the stock market falls, will precious metals fall with it? The notion is, it's almost as though we have this framework of stocks and precious metals are in one category and bonds are in another category. And, when you're playing the bond game, you swing over to fixed income. And then when you want something that will protect you in inflation, you run back to stocks and precious metals. And I'm curious to know what you think of that.
I think that that's just about as valuable as the Maginot Line was against the advance of the Germans through Belgium. It is, because it's thinking that is completely out of date, has been completely outdated by the present situation. The
right.
present situation demands that you get out of dollar-denominated assets. And you know, to talk about going from bonds to stocks is to say, well, do I want to go from strychnine to arsenic or vice versa? They're both poison. You have to get out of it. There are only two places that you can put your investments today. One is in some business that produces an ongoing stream of revenue that is relatively immune to depression, or in silver and gold. One of those two things. And anything else?
Well, I have to tell you, I do think there's some bonds that I do think there are some credits that are reliable. I really do.
Well, you need
so
to tell
if
me
you're
that.
If you're in the short term in a very sound credit, there's reason to have fixed income. So there's reason to have a CD in a local bank. I mean, there's reason to have fixed income liquidity.
Okay. Well,
now I say that
you're going to have to expand
on
that.
Well, I don't like having all my money in one thing. But I agree. I think the best thing is a operating business. But I also think that there are a variety of reasons why, having your money in something that is volatile with silver and gold.
Mm-hmm.
Is something that just makes a lot of people uncomfortable. And if you're in very high-quality short-term fixed income,
mm-hmm.
To me, silver and gold is going to hold your purchasing power.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we see a spiral down in assets in a sort of a general deflation, then you could see silver and gold fall in nominal terms. And that's a time when it's good to have some money in fixed income, and it's good to have some which is liquid.
Well, but see, Catherine, what you're doing, and
mm-hmm.
I'm not arguing against it. I'm just trying to make clear what's going on here. The difference of opinion that we have is that you're assuming that two different things can happen, and you're preparing for either one of those two things. I don't believe that two different things can happen. I'm looking for one outcome, and I'm willing to stake everything on that one outcome. Now, these are two different ways to go at the problem. I understand
right.
that. Okay, and I'm not saying necessarily that mine's better than yours. It's just that I'm a natural-born extremist from the womb, and so I'm always going to go for the extreme. I'm going to roll the dice on one throw. I'm going to roll everything on one throw, and that's just the way I'm plugged in. So. And I understand what you're saying, but for me, I'd rather, I guess I've jumped ahead to the conclusion, and I have an idea of where it's
going. Well, I do see scenarios where we don't hyperinflate. I do. And,
I do too. But we're going to talk about deflation here in a minute, I think, with some of the questions that you've got. And there's something very unusual. There's a piece of research that people just ignore, and there's a truism that people just believe things that are not true, like gold is an inflation hedge. Gold is
right.
not an inflation hedge.
Right. And in fact, I think gold works very well as a hedge in a deflationary scenario.
Right.
So let's jump to that. One of the things I want to mention, one of the best articles that I've ever seen on this topic, really extraordinary, is Robert Landis's article on gold in, as a hedge in deflation. If you do a search on the blog for gold and sextant, you'll pull it up. It's Robert Landis, and I put it up, I think, in 2005, or he published it in 2005. And, you know, what Bob basically says is gold is a hedge when people lose faith in the lawfulness and the future of the currency and the system itself. And so, you know, what he's pointing out is we're not in an economic inflation or deflation. We're in a fundamental structural change where there is a vote of no confidence in the you know, the present system. And that's a very different kettle of fish.
Well, see, now you've jumped ahead to my conclusion.
Sorry.
And you've just stolen all my thunder because Bob Landis is the one that, that got me thinking about this. And the fact is that this is not just a conclusion that you and I are making thrown out there anchored in the air, but this is based on the work of Roy Jastrom, who wrote The Golden Constant about 1974, and he wrote Silver the Restless Metal about 1978. And you can get both of those books off of abebooks.com. It's very hard to find Silver the Restless Metal. It's about, probably will cost you $175 now when a copy ever comes up. But the point is that Jastrom examined the price records for 420 years. And what he shows is that gold and silver perform well in deflations, but they do not perform well in inflations. And so we're left with this logical riddle. How is it that gold did perform well from, oh, say, 1960 to 1980? How did that happen? Why did silver and gold, under those very much inflationary circumstances, perform well? And I'm not sure that I have an answer to that, but I think I've got an answer to that. At least I've got a tentative answer to that. And my tentative answer is that gold and silver were both reacting to the long period previous to that when their prices were suppressed by government.
Right.
That is, the U.S. government did everything possible to suppress the silver price from 1964 forward, actually from, you know, 1950 forward by flooding the market with silver, and, of course, to suppress the gold price with the London Gold Pool and, you know, before that, its attempts all the way up to the 1970s when it was selling gold reserves to try and suppress the gold price. And the fact is that what brought the huge rise in gold and silver in the 1970s was most likely not the inflation, but the snapback effect of the previous government price suppression. Now, I know that's crazy, but think about it. The period from 1980 to 2000 was also inflationary, but gold didn't perform well in that period at all.
Right.
In fact, it performed terribly. It lost value. So I think what you're seeing now, the reason that gold and silver are going up now is not because of the inflation. I think it's elements in the market who are anticipating a repudiation, a revulsion against all paper currencies, against all fiat currencies.
Right, and it's the sophisticated anticipating it.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
That's what's interesting about it.
Which means that we are only on the very beginning of the price increase, Catherine. The very beginning, and that's a scary thought. See, this is one of the things that I've been thinking about is really to consider the whole inflation in the long sweep of the last 350 years, you have to think about all the government money that's been printed, all the paper, all the central bank money that's been printed in the last 350 years. And all of those have worked together. That's all a huge inflation that's worked together to suppress the prices of gold and silver.
Well, in fact, it's astonishing if you look at the official statistics.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at what I think has been issued covertly off balance sheet, it's unreconcilable.
Right.
That's how large it is.
Right. And that's the reason, I think that's the reason why, when we go back to historical prices, prices 150 years old or 200 years old or 300 years old, we go, oh, that can't be right. Nobody could live off of 300 ounces of silver a year. But the fact is they did, and they lived well. So that
well, I think the question is not how high could the price go, but I think what's not understood is how far many of the fiat currencies could collapse.
I think you're
That's
right.
That's what I think is not understood.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, one down to the practical, one question we had was which gold coins to buy, and I had to laugh because the question was let me just read it. Franklin has maintained it's better to buy coins with more bullion content for the money, such as the Austrian 100 Corona and Mexican 50 Peso. I should point out David Lichty just did a little post on the Austrian 100. You can find it up on the blog for this week. I've been following the gold coin markets for decades, and these coins have always traded a slightly lower price per ounce than coins such as the Cougarant. If these coins always trade for a slightly lower price per ounce of gold, this will be reflected when they are both bought and sold. So why is there any advantage to buying them over coins with the trade at a slightly higher premium?
Well, the answer is very simply that over time, premium always disappears. So what's going to happen is that those coins that have a higher premium, like American Eagles, Buffaloes, Maple Leaves, Philharmonics, all that stuff, will lose premium where the Austrians and the MEX 50s are already at the maximum low of premium, and so they don't have anywhere to fall. So the answer is that those higher premium coins will come to meet the lower, not vice versa, because as the market rises,
or the spreads will narrow.
Well, that's the second thing. That's the second element, is that the spreads narrow. And if we're talking about a period of time that's very short, you know, a year or less, you really come out about the same by buying the higher premium coins if you're planning on buying today and selling a year from now. But over time, that won't be true because the higher premium coins will lose premium over time, and their spreads will move down. The spread on the Austrians and the MEX 50s will narrow, and so over time, that premium, the premium on those higher price coins will disappear.
One of the reasons I laughed is I'm sure you don't remember, but the first time I bought coins from you, you recommended I buy the Mexicans and the Austrians, and I wanted Cougarants.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is I do like having a 1 ounce coin, particularly if you're dealing with people who. You know, if I anticipate that I'm going to be dealing with people who don't understand coins, having an exact 1 ounce really does make it simple with certain people.
Well, that was the marketing genius of the South Africans in the beginning when they issued the coin. But the thing that I think that, you know, the counter to that is at the top of the gold market, nobody is going to ask what kind of gold you have. They're only going to ask how much gold do you have.
Right.
That's the rule that I operate on.
Right.
The important thing is how much do you have? And so I want to get to the end. I want to get to the end of the road with the greatest number of ounces. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Then another question: how much silver can I purchase legally without declaring it?
Well, $10 zillion. If you go over $10 zillion, I have to report it. But less than $10 zillion, we're okay for. There's no reporting requirement, Catherine, on anything. It doesn't matter how much you buy. It doesn't have to be reported.
Well, if you go into – that's if you're buying through, you know, say with a check. If you go into a coin dealer and put down $11,000 in cash.
No. If you do that, he's going to look at you he's going to look at you – the same way that a dog looks at a skunk. I mean, you can't do that because he's going to assume that you're there from the government to entrap him into telling you. Well, I mean, he is.
The money laundering and currency transaction.
Right.
Rules.
I mean, but that's a different thing. That has to do not with how much silver you're buying, but how you're paying for it. And if you're trying to pay for it in cash, if it's more than $10,000 in cash, then they claim it has to be reported. And so you you get into a whole different set of problems. But that is because of the method of payment, not because of what you're buying. If you went down and you wanted to buy, you know, a Saturn automobile, and it's $14,000, and you offered them $14,000 in cash, they have to fill out a currency transaction report.
Right, same issue.
Yeah.
We got a question from someone saying, my mother wants to buy precious metals but doesn't want to hold it. To remind, we published recently options on storing precious metals that walk through a lot of the different kinds of options and gives lots of examples and the different issues. And I would encourage you to take a look at that article if you hadn't. Next one, finance bill. The bill states that gold and silver derivatives are being allowed to stay in the FDIC banks rather than carried in separate entities outside of FDIC coverage. Are precious metals derivatives allowed to stay in FDIC coverage because deflation risk could wipe out metal values, or only because the banks conduct government suppression? Well, this one gets tricky because what's in and what's out is right now is still fluid. But I, Franklin, you know my belief that they're trading, the big bullion banks on Wall Street are trading on behalf of the Exchange Stabilization Fund.
Right.
And as government positions, they're one way or another whether they're allowed to keep the derivatives business within the holding companies financed with the federal credit. One way or another, the federal credit's backstopping it, and they're trading on that account. So I think the reform bill, ultimately, if I'm right that it's for the Exchange Stabilization Fund, and it's really a government position, will not in effect. Means the finance bill will not affect in any way, nor will the commodity futures limits if the CFTC goes ahead with those. And do you have a comment on that, Franklin?
Well, you're very nice. You didn't say it this way, but I would say it's a crooked game. And what that means is that the finance bill is a way to cover up the crookedness of the game, and so it won't make a bit of difference as far, you know, if as Carolyn, as Catherine said, that they're trading on behalf of the government, they are surely going to have an exemption for anything that they're trading. It'll be clearly exempted from any other requirements. So, you know, I assume that they are trading for the government. So,
yeah, I think they are too. And what we've seen with the bailouts is even if they aren't, the government will pick up or the Fed will pick up the position if things really go down. Okay, well, that brings us to our next date. We talked last time about the sort of the historical context coming into 1913 and the creation of the Federal Reserve. But now it's time to turn and talk about 1913. If you look at I just looked at a chart from the American Institute of Economic Research that showed the decline of the purchasing power of the dollar since the 1913. And they estimated, Franklin, that $19 trillion of American savings have been wiped out as a result of the decline of the dollar, what you would say, you know, the management of inflation. And it's astonishing to me because I don't think – you know, this is such a rich country and has been such a rich country. And every year it produces such an enormous harvest of both agriculture and natural resources. You know, what's amazing is I don't think people realize how much has been stolen. I really don't. But with that, take it away.
Well, let me start with that thought, okay, because you have to remember that the embryo of the Federal Reserve is what we talked about last time, Banking Acts there are two acts, Greenback Act and the Banking Act of 1862. And what those did was they created a system to finance the war between the states. And the interesting thing to think about here is that always in the past, every war had been limited by the ability of the belligerents to finance the war. In other words, you know, you can carry on a war for a year or 2 years, but war is a very expensive undertaking, and you've got to lay taxes, you've got to lay taxes and then levy the taxes to pay for that. And there's an upper limit on that.
It was fascinating because I read when Victor Mayer came on to cover his translation of The Art of War, Sun Tzu's book, and he kind of walked through both in the book and in our discussion the history of sort of Chinese military thought, and I realized it was like an explosion went off in my head. The reason the Europeans could have Clausewitz and all the sort of unbelievable throwing resources at everything and the Chinese were very skimpy was the Europeans had the bond market and the Chinese didn't.
Right.
And that's, it might have been just that simple.
Yes, I think that's true. And of course, Sun Tzu is
that
writing...
means central bank, you know, the Chinese didn't have a central bank and the Europeans did.
Right. And Sun Tzu is writing, 20 centuries ago, roughly, before the ability to finance through a central bank and through fiat money. So you have to keep in mind that the purpose of a central bank is to fund an enormous state. That's the whole purpose of it. And whether the state is going to be at war and needs the money for war, or, and I think this is one of the big purposes of the Federal Reserve, whether the state is going to be the welfare mother to take over the costs of capitalism for its labor. Either way you look at it, the purpose of the central bank is to spend money, is to create money that could not be raised otherwise. I mean, in other words, they can't tax this money. And I think that this is a very broad view, but I think that the industrialists, from the post-war between the states period forward, were planning for that world where they would have a docile labor force and where the state would assume the costs of that labor force when it does not work. In other words, I mean, you have to go back a lot of years to this, but if you go back to somebody like George Fitzhugh, who explains when you ended slavery, when you ended serfdom, then suddenly there are all these social costs of labor that somebody has got to pay. In other words, there's the cost of infancy, there's the cost of infirmity, there's the cost of old age. These, you know, labor has to be cared for in all those stages, and the problem with a free market and free, you know, so-called free labor is that nobody is paying for them. And they're so desperate for jobs that they will bid down the price of labor to a starvation wage. So if you want the state to assume all of those costs through Social Security, through welfare, through medical care and all these things, then you can't tax enough to do it. It can't be done because people will revolt before they'll pay that much in taxes. And therefore, you have to have a federal bank, a central bank that creates the money out of nothing, out of nowhere, and actually levies the inflation tax on these people's pockets. So having laid that...
One of the various moments I've had when I sort of traveled around and tried to figure out what was going on, what I discovered was as a political formula, if you inflated away $10,000 of a person's savings in a year... Mm-hmm. And did something to lower the equity of either their value in the marketplace as labor or the value of their small business, but you turned around and gave them a $2,000 tax refund, you would gain their political support. So they would always give up, and you know they would take an indirect loss of $10,000 to $20,000 in exchange for a direct payment of $2,000.
Right, because most of them won't realize the indirect loss. That is, they won't recognize.
They didn't realize the indirect loss.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
Well, you have to recognize that the Federal Reserve was the setup for World War I and the entire expansion of the state into all of the areas that it expanded in after 1913. And then you have to look at the Great Depression not as a failure of industrial capitalism, and I distinguish between that and capitalism or free enterprise, but as a rationalization of industrial capitalism, where the system reached a level where it realized where it failed. And then in order to cure those failures, they instituted the New Deal, which included Social Security, which included various sorts of welfare, and a complete change of direction, and the government taking over control of the economy. So, and of course, when I say the government taking over control of the economy, you understand that means that the persons who control the government are taking control of the economy. So let's come back to the Federal Reserve, having laid all that foundation. What happened was that in 1907, there was a huge banking panic, and the banking panic was stopped by J.P. Morgan, who was the agent of the Rothschilds in the United States. And the Rothschilds, of course, were this enormous European banking family that had enormous power then and now. And the panic was, a lot of people think, precipitated by Morgan in the first place. But at any event, he stepped forward and stopped the banking panic. And it was a run on the banks kind of panic. And so then they had this very decorative but very pointless committee appointed by the government to go over to Europe and study European banking methods. And surprise, surprise, they came back. They issued a 14-volume report, and you can find the report in your local law library. They issued a 14-volume report that said, "Oh, we need a central bank. That's what our problem is here in the United States." And since it was all the New York bankers that they sent out on the committee to do the study, it's no surprise what they came back with. But the United States was politically very suspicious of that idea, and they were suspicious of Wall Street and the New York banks. And so what happened was that a group of New York bankers met in secret at Jekyll Island. And you mentioned the creature of Jekyll Island. The whole story is told there about how they had a secret train to take them down to this private estate in Jekyll Island, Georgia. And they cooked up this Federal Reserve Act, and then came back. And the Senator Frank Vanderlip, who is one of the relatives of that whole connected group of New York and New England families, got the thing pushed through the Senate, and they pushed it through the Senate. First, they got Woodrow Wilson elected, who was as incompetent an academic as Barack Obama. They got him elected, and then right on the 23rd of December of 1913, right after all most of the representatives and senators had gone home, they jammed this bill through the Congress, and it passed. And that was the Federal Reserve Act. And not many people really understood what had been done. But what they did, they learned from the experience of the First and Second National Banks of the United States. And if you remember those, in both cases, the crisis of their existence occurred when their franchises expired after 20 years. There's no, you can go read the Federal Reserve Act. There is no expiration of the charter of the Federal Reserve. It's perpetual. So they created a perpetual money creation machine. And once that machine was created, Catherine, here's what's so hard to grasp about the whole thing. And you have to really stand back from this, because we're all, we live in this environment, and so we don't see the horror of it. The Congress, by the Federal Reserve Act, actually gave to a private corporation the ability to create money out of thin air with legal tender status, which means they could force all the rest of it to take it under penalty of law. And the penalty of law being, if we didn't take it, then our debts were counted no good. That's
now,
what they did.
There's something else they gave them the power to do, because remember, the New York Fed which is sort of the lead flagship, is the depository for the U.S. government. So they gave them essentially control of the federal government accounts, which is an enormous power, particularly if you are free to run them outside the law, which I would suggest that they're doing.
But I think there's something that's even more important than that here, and that is if the Fed has control of the interest rate. Remember what the interest rate is. It's the price of money, and everybody uses money, right? Now, if I gave Catherine the right to control the interest rate, could Catherine make money knowing what was going to happen in the future? Well, of course you could. You could make a boatload of money because you know before everybody else what's going to happen. You have
in 1999. I emailed the head of public affairs, or the PR officer at all 10 or all 12 of the Federal Reserve banks,
mm-hmm.
and I said I asked two questions. One is, who owns your shares,
mm-hmm.
and the second is, what companies manage your databases and who has access to your data? Are your shareholders allowed to have access to your data? Because the reality is if you have access to all the data, I mean, so for example, all the wiring, all the wires you're batching ultimately go through the New York Fed. If
mm-hmm.
if you control the clearing systems and have access to all the data,
mm-hmm.
then, you know, Nicholas Negroponte said in a digital age, data about money is worth more than money.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about the ultimate insider trading, particularly when you can just create the money that you use to make your bets. So it's kind of an infinite rate of return.
Well, exactly. I mean, the thing is that when they got the right to create money out of thin air, in a certain sense, that's the least of the power that it gave them.
Right.
It gave them complete control of the economy, and just control
right.
of the interest rate alone would be that. Now,
right.
nobody thought that Woodrow Wilson would give the notes of the Federal Reserve legal tender status, but he did. Now, I don't know whether he was influenced by House to do that or what, but he gave their notes legal tender.
I would point out, Franklin, he later apologized.
Did he really?
Yeah. He said it was a terrible decision.
Well, then, but the point is that was a seizure of power.
Yeah.
It was really a coup d'etat because yep. they seized control of the state. And if you look at the whole history of the United States, you realize that this fight had been going on almost the entire history of the United States. And when the Federal Reserve was established, the banking party won. They won.
Yes.
And that was the end of economic freedom.
And the thing that says it all is a picture. If you get a picture and you look, I'll put one up on the blog, if you look at what's happened to the purchasing power of the dollar ever since,
mm-hmm.
what you're watching is basically an extraction of wealth engineered by the system that went into effect. So that decision essentially was the foundation for Americans losing $19 trillion of wealth.
Right, and you mentioned AIER, and they have a fabulous chart that shows the purchasing power of the dollar. And from 1792 until 1913, the purchasing power of the dollar is almost flat. Now it's got a big jiggle in the war between the states, but for most of that time, it's almost flat.
Right.
And then you come to 1913, and from then until now. The dollar has
lost. It's like a ski slope at Aspen.
Oh, it's unbelievable. It's the dollar's lost 98% of its value. So,
well, we were going to talk about government money, Franklin, but we ran out of time. So I'm going to defer that till the October precious metals report because I know we'll have plenty to talk about then, and that's an important topic, and I want to. And, you know, you really need to understand the Federal Reserve to dive into it. Just quickly, one question. We have someone asking us what we think of the film The Money Masters, and I guess that Bill Stillis made another one, The Secret of Oz, which I haven't seen, and I just wanted to ask you quickly if you thought that was good background for people who want to learn more about the Fed.
You know, I haven't seen either of those. Someone has mentioned them to me, but my standard is always, what is the basic theory that these people are following? Are they following a theory that fiat money, that is money, the idea that money is a social construct, or are they following the theory that money is has to be substance, so that every exchange is substance for substance? And that's really the criterion I use, because
right.
It doesn't matter how many good arguments people make and how many great criticisms of the system that is. The problem is that if they're suggesting a system that is wrong is basically the same system that we have, but with different people running it, then it's not an improvement.
Right. Right. Who's in control of your money? It's an important question.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much. We look forward to a very interesting next 30 days, and we'll be back for the next Precious Metals Report in October. In closing, let me mention Dr. Robert Lustig is next on the Soleri Report. The topic is sugar addiction, getting it, and getting rid of it. There is a wonderful video that I posted up on the blog called Sugar, the Bitter Truth. It's long. We'll post it with a blog post next week, and it's Dr. Robert Lustig's presentation on why he refers to certain kinds of sugar, high fructose corn syrup, as poison. And it's really one of the best videos I've seen on this incredibly important health issue. And it's a very important story for me, because during the litigation I was on the road and eating, you know, didn't have any money, eating very poorly, and ended up with what I think was a very serious sugar addiction. It took years for me to overcome it. And when I finally did, it was just like getting my life back. It was fabulous. And I just think, you know, doctors who can help us and people who can help us see this, get, you know, prevent it and get rid of it if we fall prey to it, are just wonderful, wonderful people. So I'm really looking forward to this one. So until next week, when I'm back with Dr. Lustig, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Good night and good luck.